Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. It is Thursday, and so you're probably expecting open forum, and we'll do open forum next hour, but we got a real treat for you. This hour, we're going to talk a bit about the myths about the Catholic Church, the biggest myths about the Catholic Church. We've all heard of them. Maybe we carry some of them around in our own heads, things that maybe people think they know about the church, which are not true, or in some instances, probably maliciously circulated some of these myths. 888-318-7884 is our number. And if you'd like to discuss the myths about – that's going to be a hard word for me this whole hour – myths about the Catholic Church, give us a call, 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour is Dr. Christopher Kaiser. Dr. Kaiser is professor of philosophy at Loyola Marymount University. He has been appointed to the Pontifical Academy for Life and is a consultant to the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. He graduated from Boston College. We have that in common, so I feel we're in good hands today. He earned a PhD from the University of Notre Dame. He's the award-winning author of a whole bunch of books, 14, is that right, 14, 15, something like that, The Ethics of Abortion, Thomas Aquinas on the Cardinal Virtues, Life Issues, Medical Choices. But the book we'll probably dip into the most today is The Seven Big Myths About the Catholic Church. Dr. Christopher Kaiser, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Cy. Great to be here.
And you're up the street from us, but if the street we consider I-5 the street, up there at Loyola, Marymount University, Jesuit University.
That's right.
In Los Angeles. And so what gets you to think, I got to write about the seven big myths about the Catholic Church?
Well, basically I wrote the book because I read lots of good books, I thought, that tackled the myths that Protestants have about Catholics. So the Catholics worship Mary, or that, they think that everything the Pope says and does is infallible, or, kind of myths. And so, people like Scott Hahn had written great books about that. And I thought, well, somebody needs to write a book that tackles the myths that kind of agnostics have, or fallen away Catholics, secular people, not serious Protestants, but secular people. Those kind of myths, I think, also are widespread. And so I thought someone needs to write a book that tackles those things. And so that's what I did.
And we'll probably get to all seven of them at some point. I will work our way through those seven myths. But some of these, the first one you get to, and it's probably the one people are most familiar with and in some ways most comfortable with, this myth, and that is that the Catholic Church opposes science. That's a myth that's, what would you say, about 500 years in the making. I mean, there's been lots and lots that has happened, and often certain instances are rehashed over and over again to kind of create or cultivate this myth. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, unfortunately, that is a really common myth. And I think, though, if you approach the question scientifically, what we would do is look for evidence, right? Mm-hmm. So what is the evidence that the church is in favor of science? Well, I would say things like the Catholic Church sponsors universities, and all these universities have physics departments and chemistry departments and biology departments. Now, if you were really opposed to science, would you do that? How can we explain the many Catholic scientists that have made enormous contributions to science? People like Copernicus, a Catholic cleric.
Right.
People like Father George Lemaitre, who was a priest who proposed first the Big Bang and convinced Einstein that this was correct. There are professors at Harvard, professors at Princeton, who are practicing Catholics. So they don't think that the church is opposed to science. And the reason that the church is in favor of science is that the church thinks that all truth comes from God, that all truth, whether it's a truth of faith or a truth that we find in nature, ultimately has God as its source. And so because God is not contradictory, there can never, in principle, be any contradiction between faith and reason. And that's why people like Augustine and Thomas Aquinas and John Paul II and Pope Francis have all taught this idea of the harmony and compatibility of faith and reason. And that includes the harmony and compatibility of the Catholic religion with science. So, again, a lot of people do think this, but it seems to me upon assessing the evidence, it seems to me the evidence is very strongly in favor of the idea that the church is not against science.
Right. The modern understanding of genetics has its roots in the work of Gregor Mendel.
Right.
I think he was a monk, wasn't it?
That's
Augustinian
right,
or something.
Yeah.
And then there's Pope Sylvester. That one, I always love it. If you really believe it, go look up Pope Sylvester and see if you still – I think it was Sylvester II maybe. Even the Pope today, he's got a training in science.
That's right.
Doesn't he?
He
was trained in chemistry.
Chemistry, that's right.
Sometimes I suspect – and I probably shouldn't. I should be more charitable than this. An ulterior motive in promoting this idea that there's a conflict between science and religion in general, and most specifically between science and the Catholic Church. And that has to do not with telling the truth about things, but with removing the moral maybe authority of the Church from the work that scientists do. That maybe we want to be out from under questions about right and wrong. When we're doing some of the things we do scientifically.
Yeah, no, that might motivate some people. And I think other people are really confused, as it were, about the differences between kind of Protestant fundamentalism on the one hand and the Catholic interpretation of Scripture on the other. So one of the classic ways people think faith and reason are opposed is they say, well, look, Genesis says that God created the world in 6 days.
Yeah.
And evolution tells us, and science tells us, that the universe has been around for a long time. It wasn't done in 6 days, and things evolved, etc. And so, what they do, these people, is they conflate and misunderstand a kind of a fundamentalist Protestant understanding of Genesis with a Catholic interpretation. So, as you know, in the Catholic tradition, some people have interpreted Genesis as meaning 6 literal days. St. Ambrose thought that. But most people in the Catholic tradition, people like Augustine, Aquinas, John Henry Newman, John Paul II, Benedict XVI, Pope Francis, have interpreted Genesis as 6 days as not meaning 6 24-hour
right.
periods. And so in the Catholic tradition, once you interpret Genesis in that way, well, then these alleged contradictions between religion and science really fade away.
Yeah. But there is a way in which, when you talk about Aquinas and Augustine especially, these are pre-modern figures. They predate modern science. So some people would say, well, sure, you've changed your view about Genesis because of all the stuff that modern science proved. But they do have a point in the sense that we have the church's thinking on many things is changed by what science reveals to us. That's a perfectly reasonable thing to say.
Well, yeah, and in a way, Augustine talked about this. He didn't obviously talk about contemporary science, but in his work De Doctrina Christiana, what Augustine says is that when you're interpreting Scripture, it's perfectly fine to use all available secular knowledge to shed light on what the Scriptures mean. And so that principle is one that Catholics have continued to use. In other words, it's perfectly legitimate to use secular understandings of different things in order to try to shed light on what Scripture means. Now, some things aren't really useful for doing that, but other contemporary scientific findings might be useful for that. But this idea that Scripture can only be interpreted in a kind of fundamentalist sort of sense is, again, it's not something cooked up just to respond to the problem of evolution or something. This is something that goes back centuries and centuries in our tradition, right? This idea that even though Scripture teaches the fullness of truth, our interpretation of Scripture is something that is, there's many different senses of Scripture. And so we're not locked in as Catholics to, Genesis has to be interpreted just this one way, 6 24-hour days, and that's it.
Right.
Again, there are some Catholics who do have an interpret that way, but they're frankly in the minority. Most of the Catholic tradition has not interpreted Genesis in that way. So we as Catholics are free. You can take it that way if you want, but you don't have to, and most of us in the tradition haven't.
The Seven Big Myths About the Catholic Church is Dr. Kaiser's book, among many of his many other books that he has published. The Church Opposes Science is the first big myth, but 6 more to go. 888-318-7884 is our number, 888-318-7884. If you would like to discuss the myths about the Catholic Church, the myths, and I think it's an interesting point that you made. It's really the myths that the world out there holds about. It's not necessarily, you did not, you intentionally did not just address, oh, Protestants say this about Catholics, because there is plenty of other material out there on those things. These are the generalized world, you know, held myths. The world holds these myths about the Catholic Church. Again, 888-318-7884 is the number. Dr. Christopher Kaiser is our guest. We'll be right back to discuss the seven big myths about the Catholic Church some more after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and you've probably heard me explain Catholicism to non-Catholic callers on the radio or engage opponents in formal public debates. I've always hoped these interactions would show people how to graciously defend and share our faith, but they're not enough. That's why I've created a weekly podcast that will help Catholics answer the toughest objections against our faith. Every episode of the Council of Trent will provide listeners with a conversation roadmap that will help them share their faith with anyone. Keep in mind that I hate boring lectures. These podcasts will contain entertaining, informative, and practical explanations of the faith, as well as interviews with the best Catholic writers and speakers in the world today. Visit TrentHornPodcast.com today to find out how you can subscribe to my new podcast. That's TrentHornPodcast.com.
God helps those who help themselves. Preach the gospel always. When necessary, use words. Sayings like these are such a part of tradition that we assume they come from the Bible, the saints, or famous Christian writers, even though nobody can seem to place their origin. By sheer repetition, they have acquired a halo of truth. In What the Saints Never Said, Trent Horn takes over 40 of these well-known but actual dubious sayings and attempts to track them to their true source. The result? He finds some that are close to what was really said, many that were misattributed or twisted beyond their original meaning, and more than a few that were just plain made up. By setting the record straight, Trent roots out theological errors that can lead us away from Christian truth and offers authentic quotes from Scripture, saints, and scholars that will draw you closer to that truth. Get your copy of What the Saints Never Said today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking the seven big myths about the Catholic Church. That's the title of the book from Dr. Christopher Kaiser. And I probably should just run down all seven of them so you know what they are. Because if you have a question on one or would like to call and discuss one, you're welcome to do that. So we talked about the church opposes science. Then the church opposes freedom and happiness. What? Seriously? You're saying that that's not true? Oh, sorry. The church hates women. That's point number three, or myth number three. The church is indifferent to love. The church, most specifically in the banning of contraception, that's the myth of opposition between love and procreation. The church hates gays. The church opposes same-sex marriage because of bigotry, and priestly celibacy caused the sexual abuse of minors. Those are the seven big myths that we'll cover today, and that Dr. Kaiser covers in the book. We'll go now to a caller. Rebecca in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Rebecca, thank you for your call. You're on with Dr. Christopher Kaiser.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I was just wondering, I don't know if this is completely relevant. However, my sister and I were discussing the other day. Her and her husband have four children. My husband and I are currently pregnant with our second child in a year.
Oh, congratulations.
All planned. Thank you. Ours two were planned. My sister, her and her husband do natural family planning, and the last two were a surprise. And her and I were discussing if the church opposes all forms of contraception because natural family planning doesn't necessarily work for them, and they're afraid to even touch each other, which obviously isn't healthy in a marriage. however, they're not ready for another child, and we were wondering if there was any contraception that is allowed in the church.
Rebecca, thank you for that call. It does certainly relate to chapter 4 in this book.
It does. Yeah, it's a good question. And I think to understand the church's answer, it's important to take a step back, you might say, and to think about the value or the good of procreation. In other words, if you were to say, well, why does the church teach that we shouldn't steal? Well, the answer to that would have to be found in the value of private property. Or if you say, well, why does the church want us to be truthful? and not lie. Well, to understand that, you'd have to understand, well, what's the value of being truthful in your communication? So let's think about the value of procreation for a second. I think that procreation contributes really greatly to the well-being of the parents. And there's a number of reasons for that. One of them is that if you think about the nature of erotic love, what is that? Well, people have defined erotic love in different ways and thought about it in different ways. But one way to think about it, and this comes from Plato's Symposium, Plato said that when you're really in love with someone, you want to be as united as you can be with that person. You want to be fully united with that person. So he thought of erotic love as a drive towards being as fully united with someone as you can. Now, if we take that understanding of erotic love, you can probably see right away how having a child with someone is a way of instantiating what erotic love is all about, right? Because when you have a child with somebody, you're fully united with that person, not just for the moment, but as long as that child shall live. And the child really is a physical embodiment of the unity that exists between the husband and wife. And not only does it unite you in a physical way, but it unites you also in terms of your emotional life, because almost always both husband and wife deeply, deeply love that child. And when things go well for the child, they're both happy. And if the child's sick, they're both scared. And so it unites them on that emotional level too. Moreover, I think having a child together strengthens the friendship that can exist between husband and wife. And the reason for that is if we think of friendship as a shared activity and a shared emotional life, then again, the child's going to provide that in spades, all kinds of working together to raise the child. And then finally, I think having kids is a way of helping us to get to heaven. And the reason I say that is Jesus in the 25th chapter of Matthew says that in the last days, he's going to separate out those going to heaven from those that aren't. And to those going to heaven, he's going to say, I was hungry and you fed me. Right? I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was naked and you clothed me. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. And he says to those people, come into my kingdom. On the other side, though, you have people that aren't going to heaven and they didn't do any of those things. So I remember when I was a kid and I heard this gospel read and I kind of looked around the church and I thought, oh my gosh, this is horrible. Everyone here is going to hell. I mean, who does these things? You know, Mother Teresa and her sisters, they do these things, but like normal people don't do any of these things. But then, you know, after I had my first child, I realized, you know, every good father and every good mother literally does all these things, right? The baby's hungry and they feed the baby. Baby's thirsty, they give the child something to drink. Baby's naked and they clothe them. And every child comes into a family as a stranger, but good parents, you know, welcome that child into the family. So maybe on the last day, the good Lord will look out at many of us parents, and on the basis of us being good parents, will welcome us to heaven. So why am I saying all this? I'm saying all this to make clear that procreation is a great good. And that is behind the church's teaching that all acts ought to be open to life. In other words, we ought to never use contraception. And contraception is what? It's any action that before, during, or after the sexual act is specifically intended to render the sexual act non-procreative. Yeah. To put it in a different way, what contraception is an act against procreation. In a similar way, a lie is an act against the truth, or theft is an act against private property. So what the church says is we shouldn't steal. We shouldn't act against private property. We shouldn't lie. We shouldn't act against the truth. And the church teaches we should not act against procreation by using contraception. So where does that leave us? Well, that leaves us not with an obligation to have as many kids as biologically possible. People you know, people I know, and in my own life, there's been times where my wife and I, we judged, look, this is not maybe the best time to have another child. So I'll give you an example from my own life. When I was at the University of Notre Dame studying for my degree, I was making $10,000 a year. And we already had three kids. We had no health insurance. And my wife and I talked about it. And we said, well, you know, we got a family of five living on $10,000 a year. Probably not a great time to add, you know, another baby. And so what we did is we used natural family planning. And today, natural family planning is even more effective than it was when we used it, because today you can get over-the-counter aids to help a couple figure out when they're fertile and when they're not fertile. And so natural family planning is akin to not speaking the truth. So we all recognize there's a difference between lying, and that's when you tell someone something that is against the truth. If I say, this morning for breakfast, I had a pizza. I didn't, but say I say that, that would be a lie. But if I just don't tell someone about what I had for breakfast at all, I just don't say anything, well, that's not a lie, right? In other words, we don't have a general obligation always to tell every truth that we know. And in a similar way, we are under no obligation to always have a child whenever it's physically possible. So many couples, including my wife and I, for good reasons, have judged that, well, right now is not a great time to have another child. And so you can space out children that way. And that is perfectly permissible. So this is a hard teaching, though. Just like I think it's a hard teaching to love your neighbor as yourself. I find that incredibly hard, to love God above all things, to pray for your enemies. I mean, all these things, I think, are very, very challenging. But the good news is that in the Christian life, you have the great demand, you know, to live the way Jesus lived. And coupled with that, you have great mercy. Because I think all of us, to a greater or lesser degree, can fall short of what Jesus asks us. So the church's contraception message, I think, has to be seen in terms of the overall message of Jesus and the overall call to us to be heroic, to do something very challenging on this great adventure we call life.
Rebecca?
Yes.
Any thoughts?
That was all beautifully explained. I feel like you had that all prepared even before I called because it was so intellectual and really, really hit home. I appreciate it so much.
He did have it all prepared. He wrote a whole chapter on it in this book, Rebecca. he wasn't actually reading from the book, but he was prepared. Thank you very much, Rebecca. And I do hope it is helpful because, as Dr. Kaiser said, it is a hard teaching and one we may resist to the degree that it feels overwhelmingly hard. But it's certainly a liberating teaching, liberates us.
Yeah. No, I think it is hard, but I think it's actually easier than many of the other teachings of Jesus. Right? Yeah, in other words, you know, love your enemies. That's really hard. Forgive those who persecute you.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, there are things in the Christian life that are very, very demanding that I think almost all honest people have to say, wow, I'm not right hitting the mark on that one.
Yeah.
But again, that's one of the great things about being Catholic is I think everybody who's honest recognizes that they miss the mark and that they fail in various ways, just like everybody makes garbage. But the good thing about being Catholic is we have a way of taking out the garbage. You know, a lot of people, they make garbage and it piles up and they got piles of garbage and it's stinking. And, you know, the banana peels from a month ago are just in the corner. But we're really lucky because in most parishes, every single Saturday, you know, at 4 o'clock, we can take all the garbage out, get rid of it, start over. And, you know, that's what God wants. You know, look, he knows we're weak, but he calls us to start over, to begin again, especially, you know, in the season of Lent. That's what Lent's all about.
Thanks, Rebecca. The 7 big myths about the Catholic Church is the topic today. Dr. Christopher Kaiser is our guest, and he had pizza for breakfast this morning. I'm really jealous of you that you had pizza for breakfast this morning, although I have a lot of respect for you. I really respect people that eat.
You know what I had for breakfast this morning, actually?
Yeah, what?
Kale.
Kale?
Kale.
My feelings just changed so profoundly. How I feel about you changed so profoundly.
I'm sorry. No, I have kale every breakfast, virtually every breakfast.
I don't even know that I would recognize kale.
Is this it? Where is the interview over? Where I'm just going to leave the studio, out?
Can we get Jimmy in here early? Let's start trying to get another call in before we have to go to a break. We're talking about the myths, the big myths about the Catholic Church. We're going out to Joe in Scottsdale, Arizona, listening on the EWTN app. Joe, your question for Dr. Christopher Kaiser.
Good afternoon. My question is about the scientific method. I've heard it argued that the church developed the scientific method, but I've also heard it contradicted as well. So can you talk on if the church developed it and when and how?
That's a good question, and I don't think I have a great answer for you other than to say a few things about the relationship of faith and reason. So one of the big themes that the Catholic Church has emphasized from the very beginning is that faith and reason really work together. And the reason for this is found in the Gospel of John. In the very beginning of the Gospel of John, it says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God." And the text says that God made everything through the Word. So the idea basically is that God's creative power is the organizational force of the whole universe. This is seen also back in Genesis, right? Where in Genesis, the text says, you know, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And that's really important because at the time Genesis was written, there were other rival myths of creation that basically thought of creation as being the result of a cosmic battle. And if that were true, what you'd expect is that the created order would be disorderly and chaotic and, you know, a total mess, like a battlefield is. So in the text of Genesis and in the text of John, what you have is this idea that creation itself is not a chaotic mess, but rather is the result of an intelligence, is the result of creative speech. And so this supposition that the world is not chaotic but orderly, that it reflects intelligence, is what is the foundation, really, of the scientific method. In other words, you can't do science, and you wouldn't do science unless you first thought, well, the world is orderly, and I can discover the order here and figure out how it works. So there can be disputes about exactly who discovered the scientific method. Sometimes people say Francis Bacon. But I think the deeper point would be that it's the Catholic Church and also the Jewish religion who gives this idea of the universe as orderly and therefore intelligible, and also the idea of the created order as not divine. Because if you think of, as many ancient people did, the sun, moon, and stars as divine, well, then you don't study it, you worship it.
Joe from Scottsdale, thanks so much for that. Christopher Check, our president, is here in the studio, so I would be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to mention we have a conference on faith and science. It's coming up September 27th right here in San Diego. Go to Catholic Answers Conference if you want to know more about that. And that, Dr. Kayser, is what we call a shameless plug. We are talking about the seven big myths about the Catholic Church. More of that after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
We need Catholic radio because we need the voice of the Church in the public forum. We live in a time that the secular voice dominates so thoroughly that we need to get that Catholic perspective out. Just as Fulton Sheen used radio and TV in the last century, we need to continue to use. This means to announce the Catholic faith in the public forum.
Bishop Robert Barron thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
50 years ago, Blessed Pope Paul VI released his encyclical Humanae Vitae, reaffirming the Catholic Church's condemnation of contraception. Catholic Answers magazine is marking the anniversary with a very special issue delving deep into what is arguably one of the Church's most controversial documents in modern times. Want to be sure to get your copy? Subscribe right now to the best Catholic apologetics magazine anywhere by calling 818-487-2011 or by going to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. We'll take you on an exploration of the crucial social and theological issues surrounding the encyclical and try to answer questions about the theological core of the issue of contraception, possible limits of the document's teaching, what led the Pope to issue the encyclical, and so much more. Don't miss out on what will be a virtual handbook on the most important aspects of Paul VI's profound and prophetic document. Don't wait another moment to subscribe. Call 818-487-2011 or go to the shop at Catholic.com right now to get subscriptions for yourself and those you love. Share the faith. Defend the faith. Catholic Answers Magazine from Catholic Answers, the most trusted name in Catholic apologetics.
Super big show today on Catholic Answers Live. Second hour, Jimmy Akin will be here for the third time this week. It'll be open forum. Any question that you've got on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, all those questions are welcome during open forum. And if you're expecting open forum this hour, we're hanging on until the next hour for that because we have the great privilege of having Dr. Christopher Kayser, who is speaking to our local San Diego Legatus group tonight, so therefore he's in San Diego, and we have the great opportunity of talking with him about the seven big myths about the Catholic Church. Dr. Kayser is a professor of philosophy at Loyola Marymount University. About an hour and a half north of us?
That's about right.
Yeah, you're right next to LAX, right?
That's right. Yeah, just north.
Yeah, so if you fly out of L.A. or into L.A., look down, you'll see Loyola Marymount University. A whole bunch of calls, so I guess we will head back to them. Let's go to Charbel in Buffalo, New York, listening on the Station of the Cross. Charbel, your question for Dr. Kayser.
Hi, hello?
Hello, Charbel. You're on with Dr. Kayser.
Hi, yes. I have a question, so... Recently, I was having a conversation with my friend about the child sexual abuse cases in the Catholic Church, and he said that, why do you still go to church? I mean, he says that by my being a member of the church, he says that I promote and support the cases through my membership. He said that, like, why are Catholics? How do I explain to him, like, that's not the case? Because okay. I mean, surely what the priests have done are horrendous and condemnable. But how do I explain to him my participation in the church? Does not, like, I'm not, like, those who commit such acts are responsible for themselves, but how do I explain to them that my membership has nothing to do with their actions?
Charbel, it's a great question, a really great question, and it's perfect for this hour, because one of the myths in the book, The Seven Big Myths About the Catholic Church, is priestly celibacy caused the sexual abuse of minors, the myth of priestly pedophilia. So let's let Dr. Kayser address that. How do you answer, Charbel?
Yeah, I agree, obviously, with, you know, what was said about this being absolutely horrendous and intrinsically evil and horrible. I mean, it just was just terrible what some of those priests did. At the same time, I think it is a wrong move to say, well, some priests did this, therefore I'm going to have nothing to do with this institution any longer. So the assistant coach at Penn State football team, right, was convicted of abusing I don't know how many different children, some 40 or 50 or something. But clearly you wouldn't say, well, therefore I should never watch a football game again. I mean, this whole thing is terrible. There's been many, many teachers, countless teachers of grade school, high school, have been convicted of sexual abuse. But it would clearly be fallacious to say, well, that's it. I'm done with education. Not sending my kids to school. I'm not going to learn anything more. I'm done with education. Unfortunately, the sexual abuse of minors is something that is widespread in our society, and you find it among all kinds of different professions. And one of the things I talk about in the book is how, yes, it is true, unfortunately, that some Catholic priests have abused minors, but it's also true among virtually all other groups. If you look at, for instance, married men, right, very many married men or married Protestant clergy or rabbis, unfortunately, have done the same thing. So one of the myths I explore is this idea that somehow celibacy caused them to do these horrible things. And if you just got rid of celibacy, well, there would be no problem. But this is clearly fallacious. There's no psychological evidence whatsoever for the idea that celibacy caused them to do those bad things. And so it's a fallacious way of thinking that's not based on the evidence. So the answer to the issue, you might say, is that in the Catholic Church, as in all groups, there are people that are terrific and there are people that are horrible. I mean, whenever you've got more than a billion people in your group, you're going to find some absolute terrific people like Mother Teresa, and you're going to find some horrible people like mafia dons, right? I mean, we're a big group. But it seems to me that people like Mother Teresa, the saints, are the ones that really are doing what the church calls them to do. In other words, someone who followed Catholic teaching to the letter isn't going to be somebody who's abusing children, but rather someone like Mother Teresa, who's loving God and loving other people as best they can. And so the people who don't do that, like the priests who abused minors, those people are violating everything the church stands for. They're violating their vows, and they're violating the most basic and elementary principles of Christian morality. So, you know, if we're going to only join groups that have perfect members, we're going to find it pretty hard to find any group to join.
Charbel, what do you make of that?
I mean, that's exactly what I... That exactly makes sense, because I hear of, it's unfortunate. I mean, it's sad that it happens, but the reality is that it happens everywhere. But also, like, here's another thing, like, what should we do as Catholics for anyone who commits such horrible acts? Like, what's the best way to lead them back to God? Like, because I've heard that, you know, psychological research, those who commit such acts, some of them, they don't feel sorry or feel sorrowful.
That may be, I don't know, but...
Yeah, I'm not really an expert on the psychological, you know, background to these sorts of things. I know in the Catholic Church in the United States, basically, if a priest is found to have sexually abused a minor, they're removed from active ministry. That's it. They may no longer, you know, be a pastor or work in a parish or a school, and that they're out. So the Catholic Church in the United States has very, very, very strict rules about this. And that's why the Catholic Church in the United States is one of the safest places for minors. In the book, I talk about in the entire country, right? So you're talking about 75 million Catholics in the United States around there. There was only 6 cases of sexual abuse of minors by priests found a couple years back, and like 7 cases another year back. I mean, you find, if you look at just one public school system, Los Angeles, you're going to find way more than that just in one little public school system. And I agree with you. It's awful. It's absolutely terrible that this takes place. But it's also completely unfair to single out one institution and say, well, you know, I'm going to judge you by your very worst members, the people that totally violate everything you stand for. And that's when I make the basis of how I judge you. I mean, you know, again, you'd hardly – it's negative stereotyping if I say, well, all football coaches are bad because Jerry Sandusky was bad, right? Or all high school teachers, they're obviously all bad people because of what a few of these terrible people have done. That's negative stereotyping of a very fallacious kind.
Thanks, Charbel, for that. I do think we – I mean, one of the things that I think really bothers people is that institutionally bishops are given the duty of making sure these things – are dealt with properly, and in many cases that is not what happened. And so we do kind of bear a burden of that. I would hope they've learned their lesson by now. But would you agree with me on that, or do you think that's
I totally agree. I mean, I think the bishops themselves recognize that many cases were not handled properly, and I don't think that was because of ill will. In other words, they're like, whatever, I don't care.
Yeah,
I think at the time, basically, this, you know, most of these cases happened in the 1970s. And at that time, many psychologists were telling, you know, bishops, well, look, this is a little bit like alcoholism. And you just send them to dry out and you have them do AA. And it is true that many alcoholics can go their whole lives, 50 years without drinking again, and they are fine.
Yeah.
And I think in the 70s, many psychologists were telling bishops, oh, look, this is a similar problem to alcoholism. Don't worry. We'll just send them away for a little treatment. They'll come back. They'll be good as new. Now, unfortunately, it turned out that it was not true.
Right.
And it's unfortunately many people got hurt in the process. So I think it's I think everybody agrees, including the bishops, that they unfortunately did things that were wrong. I think there's no two ways about it.
Yeah. And it is terrifying to see how sexual abuse just seems to be present across everything in our culture. I mean, just this thing with the Olympic girls, the gymnasts. I don't know if you heard. Yeah, you heard.
Yeah,
about that.
Yeah, with a coach. I mean, the coach, the doctor.
Kind of madman.
Yeah.
And just scores of lives. No, scores
it's
and
awful.
Scores of lives.
It's awful.
It's horrific. And we do appreciate the call, Charbel. But and I hope that answer will, in fact, be helpful to you. Let's go to Donald in Atlanta, Georgia, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio. Donald, you are on with Dr. Christopher Kaiser.
Professor, I teach catechism, and I've given a couple of lessons on the pro-life issues, and want to present them to you and see if they're legit. There's two principles primarily. One is that principle one is life itself is a gift from God. Consequently, the process of bringing life into the world is consequently sacred. So contraception would be essentially like a blasphemy, because you're essentially playing with something that is holy, and you're desecrating it, and that's why contraception is wrong. And then the second principle would be the faith teaches about the dignity of people, and consequently contraception essentially objectifies one of the partners in the act. Contraception objectifies the baby, and this is contrary to the dignity of people. And the dignity of people, we get that from being in the image and likeness of God.
All right,
so that's morally wrong.
Okay, I think we got the explanation. So. What do you make of that as a catechism?
Yeah, so I think the insight is a good one. And the insight is basically to say, look, at least on a Christian view, all human beings have intrinsic dignity and value. All of us do, regardless of race, regardless of anything. So we all have dignity and value. And in a similar way, you might say, look, if gold is valuable, well, then a gold mine is valuable, right? If it's true that you know, cash is valuable, money is valuable, well, then a lucrative career is also valuable. So if it's true that each one of us as human beings is valuable, well, then it seems to follow that procreation is valuable. And if procreation is valuable, well, then it seems to be problematic to act against procreation. And that's what contraception is. Contraception, think of that word even. It's contra, which is just Latin for against. So contraception, you're acting against conception or against procreation. And so I think the insight's a good one. And the way I would put it is to say that contraception is problematic precisely because of the value of every single human being. And if every single human being has value, well, that which gives rise to us, namely procreation, has value. And there's something problematic about acting against procreation.
Donald, well, we have to head to a break now. Thank you very much for that call. I hope that that was helpful. We're talking about the 7 big myths about the Catholic Church. That's one of at least 14 books. I don't know if I can count them all, but one of at least 14 books from Dr. Christopher Kayser, who is our guest this hour. Our number, 888-318-7884. We'll be right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live. Hi, this is Cy Kellett. It's easier than you may think to have a Catholic Answers speaker at your conference or parish event. We've got the speakers fired up, and knowledgeable Catholic Answers speakers have their bags packed and are ready to come see you. Go to CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com to find out just how easy it is to have a Catholic Answers speaker at your next event. That's CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com. Carlo, get your feet off my suitcase.
Howdy folks, this is Jimmy Akin, and I have exciting news. Starting this spring, Catholic Answers Live will begin appearing weekly on EWTN television. What's more, you'll be able to watch it no matter where you are, from Catholic.com, using your computer, phone, tablet, smart TV, or other device. Catholic Answers' mission is to use every means we can to reach people with the message of Christ and His Church, and this will be our first weekly television program. That's why we need your help right now. Producing a quality professional television show is not cheap, and it can only happen with the generous support of donors like you. To make your donation and get a free copy of the videos, visit Catholic.com and click the Catholic Answers television banner, or call us toll free at 888-291-8000. That's the Catholic Answers television banner at Catholic.com, or call toll free 888-291-8000.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, the 7 big myths about the Catholic Church, distinguishing fact from fiction about Catholicism. That's the book from Dr. Christopher Kayser, who is our guest this hour. I want to take just a minute because we have not had the opportunity to delve more deeply into some of these that are very, very important. I can't more highly recommend Chapter 4, especially this year in the 50th anniversary of the Humanae Vitae encyclical, because I just don't – I mean, it's still a battleground, and even a battleground of people of very good conscience struggling to grasp what it is that the Church is teaching there. But I want to get into a couple others. We did talk about priestly celibacy. We talked about the Church opposing science. What about this? The Church opposes freedom and happiness. That is a thing that a lot of people, you Catholics, you don't really care that anybody's happy. All you care about is, the next life. So you're perfectly willing to just let people suffer in this life.
Right, right. Yeah, people do think that, and you hear that once in a while. And again, I think it's completely a myth. I mean, there's no institution on planet Earth that cares for more people in terms of their bodily material needs here and now than the Catholic Church. I mean, feeding more people, educating more people, providing hospitals for more people. I mean, the Catholic Church does more than any other institution around to do all those things. It's not at all the case that everyone in the Catholic Church, all they do all day is pray and they just don't, care for needy people. Pope Francis obviously has really emphasized this idea that we ought to, in mercy, reach out to those in need and really try to help the vulnerable and the poor. And obviously it's not new with Francis. It's not like he made this up. I mean, this is an ancient part of the Catholic tradition. And it's not just that the Church cares for people's material well-being, which is true, but also that the Church cares for their flourishing in other respects. So, for instance, if we turn to psychology, psychology has done many studies on forgiveness. And basically what they found is that forgiveness is absolutely essential for happiness. And the reason is pretty simple, that if you don't forgive other people, basically you'll have no long-term loving relationships. You know, we'll get in a fight and they say, I'm not talking to Cy anymore, forget it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, get in a fight with, you know, John, I'm not talking to him, and my brother, my sister, my mom. And eventually, right, if you don't have forgiveness, you're all alone. And that is a recipe for deep, deep unhappiness. And the church has been pushing for centuries and centuries Jesus' teaching about the importance of happiness. Think about, for instance, in the Catholic Mass, right in the center of the Our Father said at every Mass is what? Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Think about one of the last things Jesus said before he died, right? He's hanging on the cross, struggling to breathe. And what does he say? Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Right? Peter asked Jesus famously, how many times do I have to forgive my neighbor? Mm-hmm. Seven? No, 70 times seven. So Jesus had this crystal clear teaching about the importance of forgiveness. And the church has echoed this through the ages, teaching everyone to forgive their enemies, to forgive those who offend them. And this is hard. This is a hard thing to do. But if we do forgive others, we're going to find that we have deeper happiness. Because unforgiveness is a little bit like, you know, you do something to offend me and I'm walking around with burning hot coals waiting to throw them in your face.
Yeah.
Well, in the meantime, I'm just getting burned, right? This is harming me.
Right.
So forgiveness is a way of dropping those burning hot coals and saying, look, God is just and I don't need to personally take vengeance on everybody who offends me. You know, I'm just going to let it go.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do. But again, the secular psychological research says this is a very, very healthy thing to do.
So, but there is there's this persistent idea, and I think the Marxist made this complaint about Catholics, that you just don't care about the worldly well-being, the welfare of people, that you just want to get them to heaven. And I was, of course, for the communists who were atheists, that was just all pie in the sky anyway.
Right. Mean,
it wasn't even like, oh, well, that's good, but you should also be. It was like, that's all nonsense. And this idea persists today, I think. I mean, I see some of the atheist videos where they say, well, I don't know this. Like, well, sure, you pray for people, but prayer is pointless. What do you do for people? Which is, I mean, I'm willing to accept that critique. We should be doing for people, but... You see what I'm saying? This persists, this idea that the church, really, you're mostly not concerned.
Yeah. Well, I wonder how then you explain the millions and millions and millions of hours that Catholics devote to caring for people in need.
Yeah.
How do you explain the millions, even billions of dollars the church provides for educating people, housing people, for orphanages, for hospitals, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah.
I mean, if we didn't care about earthly well-being in any way— why are we bothering doing all these things? And if you want to compare, you're talking about communism. Well, let's put atheistic communism of the 20th century against Roman Catholicism in the 20th century. So how many people did Roman Catholics kill in the 20th century? And how many people did atheistic communists kill in the 20th century? Well, Stalin killed about 60 million and Mao killed about 100 million. If you're talking about not caring for people's earthly well-being, I think killing people is a pretty good indication you're not really caring for their earthly
well-being.
That's not
your top priority?
Exactly, not your top priority. So I don't think atheistic communists should talk about caring for people very much in light of their atrocious record of murdering 160 million people in the last century alone.
Right, right. 888-318-7884 is the number if you want to talk with Dr. Christopher Kaiser. 888-318-7884. There was, just to wrap this one myth up, one of the great critiques of Mother Teresa was that she was... she was only concerned with making converts. She just wanted to make converts to the Catholic faith. She didn't really care. I mean, I don't know how people get to this, but you're familiar with the critique.
Yeah, I think it's really inaccurate. I've heard Mother Teresa critiqued from the other perspective, that she said things like, if you're Jewish, be a good Jew, right? If you're Muslim, be a good Muslim. So I don't know how that's reconciled with this idea of Mother Teresa only does what she does for the sake of converts.
Yeah.
And in fact, the whole thing is presupposing a false dichotomy. In other words, if I care for you, I have to either care for your material earthly well-being or care for your spiritual well-being. Well, this is a completely false dichotomy. It's completely stupid. I mean, it's like, you know, I only care for your right side, therefore I don't care about your left side. Well, that's nuts. I mean, no. Yeah. If you care for someone, and you really care for them and you love them, you want their well-being in all dimensions of their reality.
Yeah.
That includes physically, that includes psychologically, and it includes spiritually. I mean, love, if you really love someone, you want them to flourish in every respect. So that's exactly what the church calls us to do, is to love our neighbor, and that means care for your neighbor's well-being in all respects.
And the other part of that chapter is freedom. Like, the church is against freedom.
Yeah, again, this is a huge myth. I mean, what is freedom? That's a good question. On my view, freedom is something that's always linked to the truth. So what I mean is, I could take away your freedom by chaining you to a wall, and that does take away your freedom. But another way I could take away your freedom is if I were to lace your drink with LSD, and you're detached from reality, and you're in some, you know, fantasy world, and you don't even know where the door is, and you're, that also takes away your freedom. Think about the difference between a fully functioning normal adult, on the one hand, versus a child of the age of 2. Now, they both are free in terms of their limbs. They can walk wherever they want and move their arms wherever. But the adult is so much more intelligent and knows so much more about reality. The adult's able to be way more free. So the church teaches that freedom and truth go together. And because the church proposes the truth to people, the church makes people free, right? And again, this is echoing the teachings of Jesus, right? That the truth shall set you the truth shall set you free.
Yeah.
That's literally the case. In other words, we're only free if we're in accordance with the truth. And any freedom that's detached from truth is no real freedom at all.
Again, 888-318-7884, the number. So the church opposes science is a myth we have dismissed with, but these are dismissed much more thoroughly in the book. The church opposes freedom and happiness. What about the church hates women? I mean, you call this the myth of Catholic misogyny. That's, I think a lot of people hold that one today.
Yeah, that's very sad that a lot of people hold this. And I think upon reflection, most people can see this is clearly not true. So think about a group that's really racist, right? Think about the KKK. I'm wondering how many black people join and actively participate and are members of the KKK. Well, I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing the number is zero, mm-hmm. right? There wouldn't be one normal black person who would be in the KKK. By contrast, think about how many women are members actively participating in and helping the Catholic Church. In fact, most of the Catholic Church's membership is female, right? If you go to church on a typical Sunday, you'll find normally more women there than men. Now, are we to say that all those women are mind-numbed robots? They have no idea what's going on. They're you know, just totally out of it. Well, no. At least in the United States, Catholic women are highly educated.
Yeah.
And these are the women that are teaching in Catholic grade schools, that are working in Catholic hospitals, that are principals of Catholic schools. They are highly involved in the church, and they're highly educated. These are not stupid, brain, you know, numbed robots that are, you know, walking around like zombies. And the reason I think they're there is that they recognize that what the church teaches about human dignity, about forgiveness, about love, about caring for those that are vulnerable, is something that they believe is true. And they find not condemnation, but salvation. They find not, women put down, but women raised up. I mean, long before there was Women's History Month, this relatively modern secular idea, the Catholic Church has celebrated Women's History Month, right? I mean, think about it. We have whole months devoted to, like, May to Mary and October to Mary. We have, throughout the calendar of the church, saints, female saints raised up as models for everyone of how to behave. So the idea that the church is opposed to women, I think, is one, unfortunately, that some people have, but I think the reality is clearly the opposite. One last point on that. Think about the KKK. How many schools do you think they run for black people?
Oh, they haven't. I don't think they've started yet.
Do they have hospitals that help black people?
No, I don't think they've gotten around to that.
Haven't gotten around to that?
No,
yeah.
No.
How about the Catholic Church? Do they have schools for women?
Oh, since about the year one, I guess.
Exactly.
No, not the year one, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, and hospitals that treat women and food, clothing, and shelter for women.
Yeah.
Again, if you hate women, this is a really weird way to go about it, by providing all these things that they really need and want, education, hospitalization, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep. Dr. Christopher Kaiser has been our guest this hour. The Seven Big Myths About the Catholic Church is the book we have been discussing. The Seven Big Myths, you can get it from Ignatius Press. It's available pretty much wherever Catholic books are sold. I want to remind you that we're going up to the Religious Ed Conference tomorrow in Los Angeles. So if you're going to be at the Religious Ed Conference, please come by and say hello. We will have a booth across from the EWTN booth, and we'll be doing the show live from the EWTN booth at this very hour tomorrow, God willing. Dr. Christopher Kaiser, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed that hour.
My pleasure.
Next up, open forum. You've been waiting. I know. You've been holding on. You've been waiting. If you've got open forum questions for Jimmy Akin, Jimmy will be here in just a moment to take your questions on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church. 888-31-TRUTH is the number, and we'll be right back after this on Catholic Answers Live. We'll be right back.